Morning, everyone. Today's daf in Sanhedrin is daf Yud. We start on Testament Beis. You'll remember yesterday the Mishnah taught us that when it comes to Motzi Shemra, so it's going to be tried in front of a court, and it's machlokes in the Mishnah between Rav Meir and the Chachamim, whether it's going to be a court of three or whether it's going to be a court of 23. Now, Motzi Shemra is an interesting court case because it's really a civil case, it's monetary, but it could be a capital case, and it really kind of depends on what information comes out. So, if he's just accusing her of being a ba'ula when she alleged that, or she promoted herself as being a ba'ula, so that in of itself is just strictly a civil case. He's looking to have a forfeit or ksuva, and she obviously is looking to protect her honor and dignity. So in of itself, that in of itself is a civil case. However, if she in fact did have relations prior, and the relations happened during the course of Erusin, and there were witnesses who validated, verified that she in fact committed adultery, so then this is going to jump to a capital case real quickly. And so, at the origination of the case, at the inception of the case, how many judges does it need to preside over such a case? So, in the Mishnah brought down a machlokes between 3 and 23. And the Gemara's question was really simple. The Gemara says, well, let's see what's happening. Meaning, if he doesn't have any witnesses, and it's just a he said versus she said, and again, he's going to be afforded a certain amount of credibility. We talked about this yesterday. A certain amount of credibility due to the fact that chazakah, that there's a general presumption, a person will not go through the entire trouble of making a wedding, only then the very next day to have her forfeit her ksuva. It's not normal behavior, and in halacha we assume a certain amount of normal behavior. It's just so abnormal that he's extended a certain amount of credibility vis-a-vis money. Obviously, as we pointed out yesterday, his word that she is a ba'ula is not going to put her to death, but in other words, it's just a simple he said, she said, we're talking about money, we're talking about the forfeiture of Riksuva, so then it's going to be done in front of three. And if it comes into basin with witnesses saying that she committed adultery during Erisin, so then this is a capital case, and obviously we're going to need 23. Basically, where's that middle case in the Mishnah where there's a debate between Rav Meir and the Chachamim whether we should start with 3 or 23? It's such a basic question. The Gemara gave not one, not two, but eight different answers to this question. Yesterday, most of the daf was dedicated to those eight answers. We got through most of yesterday's daf. We are continuing in the Gemara daf Testament base. We are up to the eighth answer of the Gemara. The eighth answer of the Gemara starts off Ibai Seima. We are towards the top of the Amud. It's a short Amud, Testament base. It's about six lines from the top of the Amud. Ibai Seima. As we're going to be learning later in the Masechta, when the witnesses come and testify, so they're going to be asked basic questions and then kind of like extraneous questions. In halacha, it's what's called chakiros and bedikos. Chakiros are the most basic of questions. Specifically, when and where. When did it happen? What was the date? What was the time? Where did it happen? What was the location? The geographic location. These are the two most basic of questions that we're going to be asking the witnesses. They are the most basic questions because, as we will be talking about extensively over the course of this Masechta, and later this morning we're going to be talking about it as well. Now that we have established when and where they allege the case took place, now they're subject to Azama. If a second pair of witnesses come in and say, Imanu Yisim HaMakom Ploni, well, what are they talking about? The first set of witnesses, they were with us at the time. So basically, the second set of witnesses is contradicting the when and the where. There's no way they could have testified about that because at that time they were by us in a different location. So we're going to believe the second set of witnesses over the first set of witnesses. It's the Chiddush of Edim Zomimim. So the basic questions on when and where, what is called in Halacha Chakiros. Those are the most basic of questions. And then there are questions which are called bedikos. Bedikos are just basically a lot of extra questions. Some of them are really, quite frankly, immaterial to the case itself. But, in other words, we want to be as careful as we can to know as much information as we can. And so therefore, we're going to ask a lot of questions. Even questions which are real detail-oriented and may be very immaterial to the case itself. So the Gemara says, so let's say we have the following. Look, here's what we know for sure. If, let's say, witness number one comes in, we need two witnesses for every case. Witness comes, number one comes in and says, it happened on the 25th of the month. Second witness comes in and says, no, it happened on the 10th of the month. Okay, we're going to basically say to the two witnesses, you are obviously in perfect disagreement with one another. We're going to excuse the whole case. Right? We'll dismiss the case just on those grounds alone. If they can't coordinate on the time, so that's it. Later in the Masechta, we're going to talk about a case where they missed each other by a day. and it's an excusable error, and we're going to be discussing that later in the Masechta. But if they're off by a week, if they're off by 2 weeks, it clearly, we're just going to dismiss the case. So in a hachasha of chakira, we are done. The case is over. It's an immediate dismissal of the case. However, what if they don't? What if they don't contradict each other regarding chakiras but bedikos, and specifically questions which are really not super super relevant to the case itself? So, for example, the kamifel gibeputiv Rabbi Raman Zakai v'Rabbanan did not. The Gemara tells us a mishnah. We're going to hear this mishnah a couple of times over the course of this masechta. Ma'isu abadik ben Zakai beuktzei ta'enim. When ben Zakai was asking questions, he was presiding over a case. He was asking about a fig tree that was nearby, and he was asking about the thickness of the branches of the fig tree. Okay, were they thick or were they thin? And one witness said thick, and the other witness said thin. And is this now going to, if let's say we don't have perfect agreement upon the witnesses on the nature of the fig tree that was right by the scene of the crime, is this now going to be grounds for a dismissal of the case? Yes or no? So the Gemara says that this is a machlokas tanaim. And what happened in our particular case, meaning in our Mishnah's case, is that you had two witnesses. They were testifying over the case. They disagreed with one another over what we're now going to call bedikos, questions which are not perfectly relevant to the case itself. And is this now grounds for a dismissal? According to Ben Zakkai, it is. Therefore, it's no longer a capital case. Therefore, it's just a civil case. And therefore, it needs to be judged with only three judges. According to the Chachamim, it's still a capital case. And therefore, it's going to be tried by 23. And this is now the Gemara's eighth way of explaining the Mishnah in terms of why is there a debate whether it's 3 or 23. Okay, Adkan. That takes us now to the end of the Gemara's discussion regarding how to understand the debate in our Mishnah, whether Motzi Shema, the case of Motzi Shema, is going to be tried by 3 and 23. Okay. We have now a number of halachas that are set over by Rav Yosef and Rava, which are kind of like going to transition us to the next piece of Gemara, but in of themselves, they are super interesting, and they really speak to some very, very big ideas in testimony and in halacha. Let me just give but one word of introduction before we start with these Gemaras. We know that there's an interesting halach in the Torah which we're going to be discussing extensively in the first parak of Makos, and it's the halach of Edom Zomim. At the end of Parsha Shoftim, the Torah introduces us to this idea that if I have witnesses who come into court and they conspire, and they say that so-and-so was guilty of crime X, and prior to Beis Din arriving at a conclusion, two more witnesses run into the court and say, no, these first set of witnesses are lying, they are not telling the truth, and we know that because Imanu Ha'isim B'makom Ploni, they were with us at the time, as I just said a moment ago. When you have the first set of witnesses, they have to establish time and place. The second set of witnesses say, well, they can't have testified, or I should say better, they cannot have seen the crime in place and time X at that time in that place, because they were with us at the time. And there's a chiddush HaTorah, which is that we're going to believe the second witnesses over the first witnesses. And then what happens to those first set of witnesses? The Torah tells us, "Va'asisam lo kasher zamam lasos la'achiv." You do to them what they conspire to do to the defendant. If they accuse defendant of crime X, and together with crime X comes a particular punishment, that punishment now is going to be flipped and placed onto the Edom Zomim, onto the first set of witnesses.
There's a narrow window for that, all right?
There's a very narrow window for that. We're going to be discussing all this in greater detail in the first parak of Makos. That's the where this is treated extensively. Okay, so this is the halacha of Edom Zomim. Fine. This is going to be true whether it is a capital crime, a corporal punishment like Makos, or if it's even monetary. Even if it's Tashlamim, we are going to do to the conspiring witnesses what they intended to do to the defendant. It's all said and good. Another just quick word of introduction. We know we have the lacha of what's called Kimle B'Derabimine. Kimle B'Derabimine means like this, that when we punish a person even though his act may have multiple punishments, we only punish a person with the greater of the punishments. It's based on Psukim, it's based on Drashas. The Gemara in Ksuvos and Daf Lamin in the beginning of the third parak discusses it extensively. It's a very popular parak to learn in the yeshivas. This is the topic of Kimle B'Derabim. And also, we are going to be discussing it in somewhat more detail when we get to the eighth parak of Sanhedrin. That's later down the road. like Ayin Bey, Zayin Gimel, somewhere about there. Okay, and so therefore, if a person does an act which has in that act, let's say a death penalty and a monetary penalty as well, so you only give him the greater of the two, and this is the principle of Kimlei B'Derabim Minei. Okay, so those are just the basics in terms of halacha, and wait, there's more coming up this morning. This morning is really some of the most basic ideas, basic concepts. It's really, really, you could spend a lot of time in this daf, and apologies, obviously we do this quickly, you know, one of the minuses of the daf yomi. But well, let's begin. Amar Rav Yosef, with that stated, let's go with the Gemara. Hevi Abal Edim Shezinsa. A husband brought in witnesses, and the witnesses said that she was Mezana. So again, he accuses her of being a Ba'ula, but more than that, though, not just his accusation, he trots in two witnesses who say that she actually committed adultery. They were witness to the fact that they committed adultery, which now means that she is being accused of a capital crime. She is subject to the death penalty. Vehevi Av Edim Vehizimum Le'ede Habal. And now what the father does in return is that the father brings his own set of witnesses, and his set of witnesses are going to now be mazim. You'll hear me say that as a verb often. They'll be mazim, the witnesses of the husband. And so now, what do we do to the witnesses of the husband? Again, the Torah says vasisim lo kasher zamam lasos achiv, where they were looking to kill the kala. So now, the witnesses themselves now is going to be subject to that death penalty. So now, the truth of the matter is that I only gave you half the story. Because when the witnesses of the husband came in, so they were looking to both have her killed and also have her forfeit her ksuva as well. Now, for a moment, let's just talk about this ksuva that they're looking to have her forfeit. Now, the truth of the matter is that as she is dead, she's not going to be the collector of her ksuva, but that never bothers us because she'll have an estate. And if, in fact, she was entitled to the ksuva, so the estate will get the ksuva. In other words, the ksuva payment is due to her in theory.
Essentially, that happens only after divorce.
Or death.
Or death of the husband. But none of those are happening right now.
Okay, fine. Okay, but I understood. But in other words, but through the fact that she claims she was a basula, and now she's a basula, it's going to be a forfeiture of her ksuva. Now, it's a paper. What is that paper worth at its current rate? So anyone involved in the factoring business knows that when you're buying paper, so obviously you're not going to be paying for the face value of that piece of paper. You're going to factor. The paper itself is going to get discounted based on the fact that with the paper comes an inherent risk. Over here, the risk is great, meaning because she's only going to be getting her ksuva payment upon either his death or divorce. So, but still, the paper has value. Her ksuva document has value. And so therefore, there is a current market value to that ksuva. So therefore, when the witnesses are coming and saying that she committed adultery, what they're really doing is they're leveling two accusations on her. One is that she's subject to the death penalty, and two, a forfeiture of her ksuva, which has a current market value, albeit discounted, but it's a current market value. So really now, when the father brings in his witnesses, which are mazim, the witnesses of the husband, so they really should be getting now two punishments, right? They should be getting the punishment of the death penalty, and they should be also be getting that monetary payment, the one that they were looking to have the woman suffer in a forfeiture of the ksuva. With that stated, now what the Mishnah is telling us is a chiddush, and that is that the Edom Zomim are only going to be getting the harsher of the punishment. Why? Because of the principle of Kimlei B'Derabim Minei. Kimlei B'Derabim Minei tells me that when a person is subject to two penalties, he's only going to be receiving the harsher of the two. And this is the first halacha that we're learning together. I'm Rav Yosef, so I'm reading it again inside. Hevi Abal Edom Shezinsa. The husband brought witnesses that she would commit adultery. Vehevi Av Edom Vehizimum Le'edeh Habal. And the witnesses of And the father trots in witnesses saying that the witnesses of the husband are not telling truth by virtue of the fact they were with us at the time when they alleged that the crime took place. So the witnesses of the husband are going to be put to death, but they're not going to be paying money because of the principle of Kimlei B'Derabim Minei. Fine. Chazer Vehevi Abal Edim V'Yizimum Le'edeh Ha'av. Now let's go one more chapter in this story. It's a total soap opera. Now let's go one more chapter in, and let's say now that what the husband then is able to do is he trots out a pair of witnesses who are mazim, the witnesses of the father. If you're keeping score at home, we are now at the third pair of witnesses, and this is now witnesses numbers 5 and 6. Okay. And they say that there's no way that the witnesses of the father are telling the truth because they were with us at the time. Okay, so basically you have layers of Edim HaMazim and one on top of another. Again, based on the Chiddush HaTorah, we're going to be believing the witnesses of the husband, who are then in turn being mazim, the witnesses of the father, who, by the way, were in turn being mazim, the witnesses of the husband. I understand there's an inherent complexity in this case, but if you're following, you're really enjoying this. So the Ein Mishalma, I'm sorry, Chazav Evi Abal Eidim V'Hizimom Le'Edei Ha'av, Edei Ha'av Ne'eragin U'Mishalman Mama. So here now, the witnesses of the father are going to be doing two things. They are A, going to be killed, and B, they're also going to be paying money. Why? Why should that be? In other words, we just learned together the principle of Kimlei B'Derabi Mineh. That tells me that when a person does an act, and in that act has multiple punishments, we only give the harsher of the two punishments, right? So what the Gemara seems to be doing is the Gemara seems to be basically rejecting the principle of Kimlei, but no one rejects the principle of Kimlei, so why are they doing both? The Gemara immediately explains itself. Mamon lezer, unefashos lezer. You see, Kimlei B'Derabi Mineh has an inherent catch, and that is that when am I going to be exempted from both penalties? That's only when there is one address for the two penalties. Meaning, if let's go to witnesses number one, okay, the husband's witnesses, where they say that she committed adultery, therefore she's deserving of death penalty, and she also going to be forfeiting her ksuva. So there, those two penalties are located in one singular address, and that's her. Therefore, when these first set of witnesses become Edim Zomimim, so now the reciprocal punishment is going to go to them, and because that was geared towards one address, so therefore, what's going to now happen is they're only going to get the greater of the two punishments. But let's now turn to the witnesses of the father, who accuse the witnesses of the husband of being Edim Zomimim, where they now in turn are proven to be Edim Zomimim themselves. So now, who were they looking to kill, so to say? Meaning, they weren't going to kill. But based on their testimony, who were they going to kill? They were going to kill the Edim Zomimim. So now it's Misa Lezeh. So in terms of the death penalty, their death penalty was coming as a result of their intent, their conspiracy to kill the witnesses of the husband. In terms of the money, who were they looking to cause a loss to? They were looking to cause a loss to the husband himself. So therefore, there are two different addresses. The death penalty was going to go to the Edim Zomimim. The monetary penalty was going to be going to the husband. Once you have now two addresses, so we do not say Kimlei B'Derabim Mineh, but we now say that you're going to have to both receive the death penalty and the monetary penalty when it's Misa Lezev Amam Lezev. Okay. Hopefully I explained that well. If you want to hear that again, just hit the rewind and press play. It's like I think like a tape recorder now. It's fantastic. I'm back in the 80s. The Amr of Yosef. Okay, now what we're going to be doing is follows. We're going to be doing basically conceptually a lot more of these types of cases for the next couple of minutes. They're all similar to what we've been discussing, but we're going to be learning one new big idea in the course of this discussion. Okay, Ploni Rav Ola Onso. A person comes into court and testifies about a guy that person is a sodomizer. And oh, by the way, the victim of that sodomy happens to have been me. But Laones, in other words, I was a victim. I had no interest in being part of it, and it was against my will. So, Huva Achim Mitzarfen Lahargo. So can you serve as a witness? The answer, of course, is yes, you can. Meaning, even though you were a participant, but you were not a willing participant in the act, and so therefore, you could serve as a witness. Okay. That in of itself is fine. I know the examples over here are graphic. I understand that, but we're learning some very big concepts through these graphic cases. He is for sure no gabadava, right? I understand that, but objectively speaking, though, in other words, he was a witness to a crime. Yes, he did participate in the crime, but against his will. Just wait one second, Danny. Wait till we get to the next case, and then your question will really resonate. So the Gemara says, Liritzo, no. Now, what if he comes into court and says the following? That person is a sodomizer. Now, it happens to be that there was another partner in the sodomy, and that other partner happened to have been me, and I'll also make the following admission. I was a willing partner in that act. Okay. So, again, I understand that there's a soap opera-ish nature to this entire case over here. We are just going to clinically discuss this from the halachic standpoint, and watch what happens in terms of the halacha. So Rashi Uva Torah Amar Atasha is Rashi 8. So Rav Yosef says, well, the case over here is really cut and dry. The guy just came into court and admitted that he was a willing participant in the act of sodomy. Mishkav Zachar. You can't testify. In other words, you are now an Avaryan. You're a sinner. We're going to be learning together in the third parak of Sanhedrin that once you qualify as a Rasha, so then you can no longer serve as a witness. And so therefore this person now is admitting that he is a Rasha, and therefore he can't serve as a witness, and therefore his testimony is thrown out the window. Wait 1 second. You're absolutely right. Just please wait. Okay. So Rava Amar, so Rava disagrees with Rav Yosef, because Adam Karav Eitzel Atzma Ve'ein Adam Meisim Atzma Rasha. Rava says like this. No, you cannot self-incriminate. Now, it's interesting over here, why can't you self-incriminate? The answer is actually written in the Gemara itself. A person is related to himself, meaning I'm related to my brother, my sister, my wife, my parents, my kids. In other words, and as we're going to be learning in the third parak, when you're related to somebody, you cannot testify about somebody. You know who else I'm related to? I know this is a little existential, but I'm also related to myself. In fact, I'm no better related to anyone else in this world than I am to myself. So just like I cannot testify about another relative, I also cannot testify about myself as well. A person cannot incriminate himself. Not to be confused with American law, by the way, where self-incrimination in American law just simply means that you don't have to incriminate yourself. But if you'd like to, by all means, in American law, you may do so. Be my guest. You just simply don't have to. You could plead the fifth. In halacha, however, according to Rav in the Torah, it's when we say you can't incriminate yourself, it means that even if you come to court and you say something incriminating about yourself, you're simply not going to be listened to. You will be ignored. Even though the information has been put out there, the court just simply puts you on mute. Anything you say by yourself is just not admissible in a Beis Din. With that stated now, watch what happens over here. This is such an unbelievable conclusion. The person now is accusing another of sodomy. He actually, in the same testimony, says that he was also a participant in the act. And furthermore, he says that he was a willing participant in the act. Rava says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to accept his testimony. What about the second half of his statement? What about the fact that he himself claims that he was a willing participant in the act? We put that on mute. Because of the principle of Ein Adam Meisim Atzma Rasha. And furthermore, we're going to actually introduce another major concept over here, and that is Palgin and Dibura, which is that in testimony, if we're able to successfully cut your two statements into two, and two statements can exist independent of one another, meaning statement number one, that man committed the act of sodomy. Statement number two, and I was a willing participant. So what we're now going to do is we're going to clip that, and we're going to take the first half as admissible testimony. The second half, because you're saying something about yourself, is just simply now put on mute. And Palgin and Dibura allows us to take the first half of the statement and ignore the second half of the statement, and that person's going to be put to death based on that testimony. Now, Danny, your question that you asked me a couple of minutes ago is even a stronger question over here. In other words, is he not an Ogei Bedaver? So the answer is no, because I know that, because Rava says that Danny's asking, generally speaking, we like the testimony of witnesses when they're coming from an impartial place. Over here, there's a strong amount of partiality to what he's saying, considering that he was not only a participant, but a willing participant in the act. And what Danny's asking is that it sounds like he's an Ogei Avodaver. He's got partiality. And now I'm admitting that he's right, but his partiality is only based on his testimony about himself, which we are muting. And I understand. It's hard to mute something when you hear it. I'm just showing an awareness of, a self-awareness of, I know this halacha sounds strange. I understand it comes out strange, because although we're muting it halachically, it's not like the judges don't hear what he's saying. They hear it. But from a halachic standpoint, it's just simply not admitted. Okay. Amar Rava. Continuing in the Gemara. We're now on the very top of Yud Amud Aleph, today's daf. And Ploni Ba'al Ishti. Huva Achim Mitzdarf and Lahargo. A person testifies about his own wife who is involved in an act of infidelity and she's with another man. And the husband's testifying. Now, again, we're taking all the drama out of this, we're taking all the soap opera out of this, and we're just discussing it clinically. Can he testify about his wife? The answer, of course, is no. His wife is related to him. Right? She's a Karov. So he can't testify about his wife. Can he testify about the other man? Sure. He's an outsider. Can he testify about the act of adultery between the other man and his wife? The answer is yes. Even though we're going to really have to split his sentence because his wife's testimony is inadmissible because she's a Karov. The other man's testimony is admissible because he's another person. Even though it's obviously a description of the same act. And once again, it's another example of Pagina Dibura. Admittedly, however, this is now just me talking, just giving simple analysis. This Pagina Dibura is different than the previous Pagina Dibura. In the previous Pagina Dibura, he was saying that man committed sodomy, and then he says, and I was a willing participant. Where there, we could just literally cut the sentence into two. Over here, that man committed adultery. I guess, no, you know what? It's very similar. I take it back. I'm thinking it more throughout loud. It's very similar. That man committed adultery. Fine. And my wife was also the participant in that. And again, that's inadmissible because she's a Karov. Okay, I take it back. It's very similar to one another. Bali ishti huva achim estarf laharga. Avalo laharga. So he's now going to be subject to the death penalty, not her. My kamashman dimefalginan bidibura hainohach. The Gemara says, well, you just gave me two cases which are kind of like mirror images of one another. They're parallel cases. And so what do we gain one over the other? So the Gemara says, Mao detema adam karav etzel atzmo arminan etzel ishto lo arminan. So kamash malan. So the Gemara says, look, when we say that a person is related to himself, and therefore any comment he makes about himself is inadmissible, so that is vis-a-vis himself. But maybe regarding his wife as a havamina. The Gemara is just simply throwing this out as a havamina. The Gemara is suggesting that maybe with his wife, he can gain slightly more impartiality. And maybe with this testimony, since we're killing the other man, so therefore we're going to kill the wife as well. Meaning we're accepting his testimony regarding the other man. So that maybe his wife should also come along for the ride. And when I say ride, by the way, it's an unpleasant ride. It's, you know, in other words, she should also be subject to the death penalty. Maybe he can separate himself from his wife in this very limited scenario. That's a havamina, but the maskan, of course, is no. That his testimony regarding his wife is just simply inadmissible. She's a karov. And that's why the second case introduces somewhat more of a chiddush. Continuing in the Gemara. V'amarava. Poni ba al nara amarasa. V'huzma. A man testifies regarding a Nara Marasa. So again, we go back to the case in the Torah where a woman is betrothed. She is also a Nara, which means that she's between the ages of 12 and 12 and a half. And now, the witnesses turn out to be Edom Zomimim. Neharagin ve'in Masha Mimama. So they're going to be killed, meaning because what they conspired to do to her is have her killed. She's a married woman. Betrothal is marriage. She's a married woman. She would have been subject to the death penalty. So they now, the witnesses, are going to be killed because of the pasuk of Asisim Lo, Kajir Samam Lasos Lachif. That's pretty straightforward. In addition, they're also not going to be paying money because, in other words, again, with her testimony, they were looking to have her forfeit Ksuva, and they themselves are not going to be losing money because of the principle of Kimle B'Darabim Minei. And again, this is similar to what we discussed earlier this morning. Bito Shaploni V'Huzmu Neragin umishamen mamon. If let's say, however, when they levy the accusation of this woman was involved this woman was involved in an act of adultery, they are going to be killed. And again, she's an Ara Marasa, and they identify who the woman was. And by the way, I should have made this clear. I did not. I'm just clarifying the previous case. The previous case was they didn't identify who the girl was. Okay, they only identified who the guy was.
Is that part of the bidgah?
It certainly would strengthen their case if they were able to identify the woman. But in the previous case, they didn't. In this particular case, now they identified who the girl was. So, and I say girl, by the way, just to be more specific, she's a Nara Amarasa. She's a betrothed Nara. So, under those circumstances, Naragan and Mashamim, the Edom Zomimim are going to both be killed, and they're proven to be Edom Zomimim. They're both going to be killed, and they're going to pay. And why should that be? Again, don't we have the principle of Kimlai B'Darabi Mine? And again, we go back to a point that we made earlier this morning, which is Mamla Zeu Nefashlo Sazeh. No, says the Gemara, because when there are two addresses for the capital crime and the monetary penalty, so then you levy both. Why are there two addresses over here? Because let's consider. There we go. There we go. So let's consider. Because in the case of Nara Marasa, so who is subject to the death penalty? She is. She's the one who committed adultery. Who is the recipient of the money if, in fact, there would be a monetary payout? The father. Remember, she's a Nara. And I know it's interesting, and I know it's a little bit strange, but we discuss this a lot in the third parak of Ksuvos. When you are a Nara, you're still financially under the auspices of your father. All the monetary gain goes to the father when she's a Nara Marasa. And therefore, the father stands to be the beneficiary of the monetary payment. So therefore, the death penalty is to her, the monetary payments to the father. Those are two different addresses. Therefore, we don't apply the principle of Kimlei B'Darabi Mine. Ve'Amar Rava. One more of these. And then we wrap up these cases. Pliny Rava Ashur Vahuzmu. A man says that a person was involved in bestiality with an animal, and he doesn't specify which animal. It doesn't matter. In other words, they're accusing the man of bestiality, so therefore he's subject to the death penalty. So they're in such a scenario, they're going to be killed, but there's not going to be any monetary payment, even though someone just lost an animal. Because the halach is that when an animal is involved in the act of bestiality, the animal itself is killed. Someone's going to lose an animal. So, but nevertheless, though, the witnesses who proven to be Adam Zomimim are going to be killed because that's what they look to do to the defendant, but they're not going to pay money. Shorashal Ploni, Vehuzmu Negraganu Mashamim. If, however, the witnesses come and give a full report, which is that the man was involved in bestiality and they identified which animal it was, so now the witnesses who are proven to be Adam Zomimim are going to be killed and they're going to have to pay. Why? Because once again, there are two different addresses in terms of the Misa and the Mamon. The Misa is coming as a result of the man being involved in the bestiality. The Mamon is going to be paid to the owner of the animal. So those are two different addresses, therefore we don't apply the rules of Kimlei. Hasu Lamali, Hainu Hach, the Gemara says again, it's really a repeat of what we learned previously. So the Gemara says, Mishum Dekabai Bai Ilave, Dabai Rava. The Gemara says, in the second case, there's a follow-up question, and the follow-up question is intriguing. The follow-up question goes like this. Pliny Rava Shori. Let's say a person makes the following accusation against the man. That man was involved in bestiality, and by the way, you know who the animal was? It was my animal. Okay. So, under those circumstances, Mahu. The Gemara says, now in this follow-up question, Miyamrin and Adam Karavetz Atzmo. Now we know that a person is, again, unable to testify about himself. Right? It's just simply inadmissible. V'ein adam karaveitz mamona. However, when it comes to his money, do we say that a person does not have this kind of relationship to his money? Or do we say that a person is related to his money? What exactly is the Gemara asking over here? What the Gemara is asking over here is as follows. Remember, in a case of bestiality, so even though obviously the animal does not have das, but the animal is put to death. The Torah says that both the man and the animal involved, or if it's a woman, but the person and the animal involved are both being put to death. In such a scenario, maybe the argument we're going to make, this is the follow-up question of Rava, maybe the argument we're going to make is that just like a person when testifying about himself is muted, maybe the same thing true with his animal, meaning the Gemara is entertaining the idea that a person has this kind of relationship to his property, and so therefore, maybe his animal is simply not going to be put to death, even though the person involved in the act himself is going to be put to death. This is what the Gemara is suggesting. The Gemara says, after he asks this question, he gives a very straightforward answer, and that is, Basa Debaya Adapashi Adam Karavitza Atzma Vina Adam Karavitza Mamona. No, a person does not have this kind of relationship with his property, and therefore, when the person testifies about that man committing bestiality with his own very own animal, so his full testimony is going to be accepted, and the court is going to kill the person and kill the animal as well. Okay. Rashi notes over here that there's a Gemara in Temura. The Gemara in Temura talks about a case where a man testifies about his own animal, that his own animal was involved in the bestiality. The animal itself is not going to be put to death, but it's pasul carbon, it can't be used as a carbon. That Gemara over there in Temura seems to be going against our Gemara over here, but Rashi notes a very simple answer, which is the Gemara in Temura, he was not corroborated with two witnesses, it was just his own admission about his own property. That in of itself is not going to result in a death penalty. Our case over here is that the man was testifying about his own animal together with another person, meaning it's a formal edus of he and somebody else. It's,
right? Incriminating himself?
No. In other words, he's not incriminating himself. It's his animal. It's his property.
But he becomes a Rasha as a result of...
No. Just because your animal is involved in an act of Mishka Behema does not make you a Rasha. Rasha is when you do an Avera. Your animal is involved in Mishkav Zachar. You're not the...
Not to the bestiality.
No, but your animal was involved. You were not involved. Your animal was involved with another person.
Oh.
You were testifying about that other person.
Oh, I know. Okay. It's himself.
No.
It's that he comes forward.
Yeah, I agreed.
No.
No. Okay. Makos B'Shlosha. Okay, I know I did that very quickly. I'm again, I know we could spend a lot of time on that. I do get it. We continue in the Gemara on Daf Yud Amud Aleph. We're halfway down on the Amud, and now we're discussing the court of Makos. How many judges need to oversee a cases of Makos, of lashes? A person violates a law in the Torah, now subject to Makos, is going to court, tried again, same process. Two witnesses who had to have given Hasra to the person before he violated the law in the Torah. And now the person heard the warning, received the warning, accepted the warning, understood the ramifications of his actions, still violated the Avera, they're going to take him to court, and the witness is testifying in front of court, and the person's going to be subject now to lashes, and the court is a panel of how many. You remember the Mishnah brought down a machlokas in terms of how many should be. Your options are either going to be 3 or 23. So we start now with the opinion of 3. Minani Mili, the Gemara says, how do I know? How do I know that it should be 3? So Am Ravuna Amakra Ushfatom Shnayim. And they will judge. So again, they is plural. We always take the conservative view, which is that it's 2. And so therefore that brings us now to 2 judges. 2 is an even number. We've been now a week and a half in Sanhedrin. We know what happens to even numbers in Sanhedrin. It gets bumped up to the next odd number, so 2 becomes 3. Ve'im beisin shakal mosifin aleim od echad arei kan shlosha. That brings us to 3. Elam yatav yitztiku shnayim v'yirshu shnayim arei kan shiva. The Gemara points out that in this very same pasuk, this is at the end of Parshas Kisetse, and the very same pasuk, we also have 2 other verbs describing the beis din, which is yitztiku, which is plural, and hirshir, which is another plural. So that's 2 times 3. That brings us to the number 6. And again, 6, 7 is the new 6 when it comes to Beis Din. So the Gemara says, no, I only buy a kid to Ula. The Gemara says, those 2 psukim are dedicated to other drashas, so therefore they do not become part of our discussion. The Amr Ula, Remez le'edim zomim min ha-tor minayin. Ula starts off, this is the first daf of Makos that we're learning together. Same discussion over there. Where is there an allusion in the Torah to Edom Zomimim? To which the Gemara is like aghast at the question. What are you talking about? An allusion to Edom Zomimim? The Torah doesn't allude to Edom Zomimim. The Gemara spells it out. Ramaz Edom Zomimim v'aksiv kasher zomam. The Torah says at the end of Parsha Shoftim, you do to the witnesses what they conspire to do to others. The Torah is not hinting to Edom Zomimim. The Torah is spelling it out. So therefore, Ela Ramaz Edom Zomimim shalokim minayin. The Gemara says, no, that wasn't the point that Ula was trying to make. Ula was making a point, which is that, you know, sometimes you cannot do to witnesses what they conspire to do to the defendant. Let's go over a simple example. This is the first daf in Makos that I'm going over, which is, let's say the witnesses come forward and say, you know, he's been getting the first aliyah for years, and he's been duchening for years. And the witnesses step forward into the courtroom and they say, he's a ben grusha. His mother was a divorcee. He does not have Kedushas Kohen. And we know that because we were there at the chasna and we saw. And we know who she was. And she was a divorcee. Okay. And now the witnesses were proven to be wrong. Well, how do we know that they're wrong? Another pair of witnesses say, you were not there at the chasna. You were with us at the time. All right, great. So now we're going to reciprocate. And what they conspired to do, the defendant's going to happen to them. But let's say they're Yisraelim. And now what? Oh, I'm not a Kohen? Oh, that's terrible. That's terrible. I got it. Okay, fine. We accept the punishment. We're not going to be Kohanim. Okay, that's fine. We accept it. Now that's ridiculous, meaning they are, you cannot reciprocate the punishment onto them. What do you do? So now we have an allusion in the Torah. This is the first daf of Makos that we're learning together right now. And that is, they're going to receive Makos. Even though in general, giving false testimony in court is not subject to the Makos penalty, because as we're going to see in just a couple of moments from now, that's a lav she'ein bo ma'isa. It's considered a negative prohibition with no action. Speech is not considered an action. So therefore, under normal circumstances, they will not be subject to the Makos penalty. However, because they're Edim Zomimim, where you cannot reciprocate the punishment onto them, in such a case, they're going to receive Makos. This is what we're saying right now, and we're basing it on this pasuk and Parshas Ki Tzeitzei. Minayin dechsi v'itzikur es tzadik v'yashir es harasha. Mishim de'itzikur es tzadik v'yashir es harasha v'ayam ben hakos harasha. Gemara says the pasuk really is a little bit strange. We're going to exonerate the one who is innocent. We're going to convict the one who's guilty, and therefore we're going to give makos. What? Who are the multiple parties in the story over here? Meaning, when you give makos, who's normally there standing trial? One person. The tzaddik, the rasha, what's going on over here? So Allah, Adam Shirshua Satzadik, Vasu Aidi Achrina, Vitiko Satzadik Mikara, Vishavin Alhanak Rashaim, Vahaya and Ben Hakas Rasha. So the Gemara says what's going on over here is that this is a case of Adam Zomimim, where a tzaddik was accused of doing something bad. Witnesses come, a second pair of witnesses say, wait 1 second, what are you two doing? You were with us at the time. The tzaddik is proven to be a tzaddik through the Adam Hamazimim. Now what do you do to the Adam Zomimim, who really are the Rashaim in the story? So the ayah in bin hakos harasha, in a case where you cannot reciprocate the punishment back onto them, like in the case of Ben Grusha, so then you give them makos. That's the allusion in the Torah to Adam Zomimim, where I cannot reciprocate the punishment unto them. The tepik le melosana, the Gemara says, I don't understand. It's one of the Aser Sadibros. They lied in court. You're not allowed to lie in court. So the Gemara says, Mishum da'avale lav she'en b'maisa v'chol lav she'en b'maisa in lokin alav. The Gemara gives us the most basic rule, which is that if it were just for saying false testimony in court, that is not subject to the makos penalty. It's only in this case where you're an eid zomim and the punishment cannot be reciprocated on you. Under those limited circumstances, you're going to be receiving makos. Okay. Mishum Rabbi Shmuel Amru Be'esrim Mishlosha. Rabbi Shmuel disagrees. He says that you do not do a makos in front of 40, but rather you do... Sorry. You do not do makos in front of a court of 3. You do makos in front of a court of 23. What is that? My time to Rabbi Shmuel Amru Abai Yasser Rasha Rasha Michai V'Misos. So Abai says it's based on Xer Shava. Ksiv HaChav Ayam Bin Hakos HaRasha. That's makos. V'ksiv HaSa Mashir Hu Rasha Lamos. That's a capital crime. Malahalam Be'asim V'Shlosha Avkaim Be'asim V'Shlosha. Through the Xer Shava, the hyperlink between these two psukim, so just a capital crime is done in front of 23, so two makos is done in front of 23. Rava Amar Makos Ba'Makom Misa Omeres. Rava says no. It is not learned out through a Xer Shava, but it's learned out through a principle. What is the principle? Makos stands in the place of Misa. Okay, there is a unbelievable Rashi over here. Let's see the Rashi inside. Rashi says, what does that mean, Makos b'makom Misa omedes? That Makos is really a subcategory of Misa. I'm reading the Rashi. It's the third wide line down on the page. Dekeven de Avra Lazarus Baro Rayu Lamos. You violated the word of God. You should really be subject to the death penalty, in principle, in theory. Meaning, the Torah gives a negative prohibition. There are actually 365 of them. You violate any one of them, you violated Ratzon Hashem, principally, you should die. U'misa zeknas alav hakasov, v'areko achas min amisos. And so therefore, the penalty, at least in the abstract, in the theoretical, is that you're subject to the death penalty. V'chiyechid eskila b'fnei atzma, v'srefa b'fnei atzma, v'herik b'fnei atzma, havi nami malkus, ka'achas min amisos. And just like there's skila, and there's srefa, and there's hereg, and there's chenek, there's actually a fifth category of misos based in, and it's called malchus. Now, I understand that it's a strange death penalty because the person comes out alive. So not all the time. But we're not looking to kill him. But at least categorically, it's viewed as one of the death penalties, at least in principle, at least in theory. Rashi over here is turning into like such a lamdan. Rashi over here, you know, giving us the abstract formulation of the Gemara in terms of how Malchus is really just one of the death penalties. By the way, parenthetically, see the Bam Tosfos over here for a different way to explain the Gemara. Actually, Bam Tosfos gives two other ways to understand the Gemara, but for our purposes right now, I just present Rashi. So the Gemara says, I don't understand. You know, we're going to learn together in Malchus in the third parak, where if a person is subject to the lashes, so what he's going to receive is a estimation, right? How's the guy? Strong, weak, heavy, thin? How many do you think he can handle? The Torah instructs us to give him 39. But we don't want to kill the man. So let's say after a medical examination, we figure now he can handle, oh, I don't know, let's say 18. So the Gemara says, so you only give him 18. Gemara says, why we go through all this? If Malchus is just another form of death penalty, give him 39. And Lamachia v'imai flamos. And if the man dies, so let it be. Meaning, if Malchus is none other than just simply another form of the death penalty. Amalei amakrav v'nikla achicha le'enecha. Ki machis agve... Agaba dechaya machis. So the Gemara says no, because the Torah's instruction is hit him, meaning we need a form of him to hit, right? There's no point in hitting a dead man. And so therefore, as kind of like almost like a gzeiros hakasuv, yes, it's a form of a death penalty, but at the same time, an unusual form of a death penalty where we need the man to be alive. So the Gemara says another interesting halacha that we learned back in Malchus, and that's the following. The halacha is that the number has to be divisible by 3. So for example, the Gemara says, let's say, after the medical examination, the doctors say he can handle 20. Okay, 20 is not divisible by 3. So we go to the next number lowest, which is divisible by 3, which is going to be 18. So you give him 18. So lemichya esrim v'chada v'chi ma'itz b'hachada lemos. So the Gemara says, I understand, why are we rounding down? Let's just round up. Meaning go to 21, and once again, the Gemara says, and if the man dies, so be it. So the Gemara says, And the Gemara says, and over here, let's consider, on that 21st hit, is he alive? Sure. Meaning again, because the doctor said he can handle 20. So on the 21st hit, is he alive? Yes. And if he dies, so what? I'm not trying to be crass or rude. It's just basically, based on the principle you gave me, we should be okay.
Is there any punishment for
the that we'll discuss. Table that question for the third paragraph of Makos. The Gemara says, not only does he have to be achicha during the Makos, he has to be achicha even post Makos as well. So therefore, if you hit him, if the Emmy only gave him for 20, and you give him 21, it's true that he's an achicha during, but he also has to be achicha post as well. So therefore, that's why we round down. That's why we don't round up. Okay, Ad Kan. What do we have so far in the Gemara? We finished off the topics today of major topics, huge topics. Kimle b'derabin nimine ein ad meisam atzma rasha palgin and dibure. Some of the most basic of concepts when it comes to edus. And then, after going through some really difficult Gemaras, we then discussed. Whether or not a person is also considered a relative regarding his money as well. And then the Gemara went on to discuss how many are settling a case of Makos. Machlok is in the Mishnah between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Shmuel. Tanakhama says 3, Rabbi Shmuel says 23. The Gemara cited sources for both positions. Within Rabbi Shmuel's position of 23, a Machlok is between Abai and Rava, whether it's learned out through Gzeir Shavu or it's based on the principle that Malkus b'makom misa omedes. We stop here.